ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello from David Rutledge. This is The Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to the show. If you've been keeping even half an eye on political and social commentary over the past few years, you're very unlikely to have missed some conservative culture warrior at some point decrying the evils and excesses of cultural Marxism. Cultural Marxism is one of those wonderfully useful terms that can be deployed to explain a wide variety of social problems. For those who believe in its existence as an actual thing, cultural Marxism is the hidden force behind political correctness and identity politics and wokeness and what they see as the erosion of Western values. But then for others at a different point on the political spectrum, cultural Marxism is not really a serious explanation of anything at all, but in fact a conspiracy theory, and one that has its roots in some much older and much darker political myths. Well, today we're asking where this idea of cultural Marxism has come from. Did a group of Marxist intellectuals back in the mid-20th century deliberately set out to reshape Western culture? And if they did, how convincingly does their story stack up as a tale of secret plots and calculated ideological subversion? Because the thing about these questions is that they take us back into the history of ideas, which is wonderful, but they also force us to ask something deeper, which is how do societies respond to and explain rapid cultural shifts? When we find the world changing around us, do we look to economics or technology or social movements for explanations, or do we instinctively go in search of hidden actors pulling the strings? Well, helping me out with all of this today is Alexander Howard, Senior Lecturer in English and Writing at the University of Sydney. He has a very good recent essay in The Conversation that explores the history of the cultural Marxism narrative through a new book by the historian A.J.A. Woods. Along the way, we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories, the politics of universities, the anti-Semitic genealogy of the idea of cultural Marxism, and whether there's a meaningful distinction to be drawn between intellectual influence and ideological capture. Alex, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Now, one interesting thing about cultural Marxism is that it's kind of two things. Like, one is a conspiracy theory, which we'll get onto in a minute. But there's more going on than just conspiracy theory. And the fact is that cultural Marxism also refers to a group of philosophers who actually existed and who had some very interesting ideas about Marxism and culture. So let's begin there. Who were these philosophers?
So the thinkers that we're associating with cultural Marxism are a group of German intellectuals who are associated with the Institute for Social Research, which is an institution set up in 1923, attached to the University of Frankfurt, hence its commonly known title as the Frankfurt School of Philosophy. And if we're thinking about the Frankfurt School, we're thinking about theorist philosophers such as Herbert Marcuse, Max Horkheimer, Theodor Adorno, Erich Fromm, Jürgen Habermas. We're also thinking about people who are adjacent to this institution, really important figures that maybe we can talk about as well. So people like Walter Benjamin. And this institution is formed, and it's kind of avowedly Marxist in its orientation, in the wake of the destruction of the First World War in Europe, to understand what's happening politically and economically, and perhaps to posit some alternatives to the dominant political trends that are in train at the time. That's the reality. Cultural Marxism as a conspiracy theory takes the bare bones of these historical facts and runs with it in a completely, often wildly counterintuitive direction, to suggest effectively, if I'm going to try and do it in a nutshell, that these select band of German intellectuals, having realized that the class revolution that Marx predicts or hopes will come about hasn't occurred, decide that the best option they've got to bring about a socialist communist revolution is effectively to use culture to undermine the institutions of Western civilization and to bring about some world-changing event, historical event, by stealth. That's effectively what it posits, and it really starts to get going in the 1960s, so long after the Frankfurt School itself has been set up.
Right. So on one hand, then we have the ideas and the work of a specific group of 20th century philosophers who I suspect the average culture warrior might never have even heard of. And yet this term cultural Marxism has taken on this extraordinary contemporary political salience. It's become deeply rooted in our wider discourse. Why do you think that is?
Something, and I think we can talk about conspiracy theory more generally here. It's a useful shorthand, if you like, to get around some necessarily hard thinking about how we've arrived where we are in the world and how we might explain or try and account for things that we are unhappy with or that displeases or we find frightening. And you're right, I would say that the majority of culture warriors probably have never picked up a work by a Frankfurt School philosopher and theorist. And look, some of the philosophy and theory is incredibly dense and difficult to get your head around. But as you said, it really has taken on this I don't want to say afterlife, but it's like I said, it gets going in the 1960s and it's as a theory and it's in a way tied with anxiety on the right about the rise of what we call progressivism. And I should say also it's specifically in the 1960s, it starts out as an American phenomenon. And so I think that's something that we could think about as well if we're talking today in an Australian context about the way in which often these conspiracy theories or culture wars are imported into different contexts and what that might do to those theories or to the people who begin to attach themselves to those theories. But again, it's an interesting term itself, this idea of cultural Marxism, because I think from memory, it's first introduced as a term in the 1930s, forgive me listeners if I get this wrong, in I think some British fascist or pro-Nazi publication. And it doesn't really get any traction. It's not until the late 80s, early 90s that it begins to emerge as a term with some strange cultural cachet attached to it. And then in 2021, it's actually entered into the Oxford English Dictionary as a term, as a conspiracy theory, which displeased some notable figures on the right. From memory, I think Elon Musk was really aggrieved that it was designated as a conspiracy theory. But a shorthand, a way in which to talk about things like progressivism, political correctness, drives towards equality, the supposed dissolution of family values, for instance, the encroachment of political correctness on university campus spaces, all of this, if we're going along according to the quote-unquote logic of the theory, stem from this band of German intellectuals who were thinking in very specific historical circumstances, right? Under the threat of fascism, they had to emigrate, leave Germany, relocate to America, because they're at risk of being murdered by the Nazi regime. So this is something else we could speak to in more detail, I think, which is the way in which cultural Marxism as a theory seems to be tied in some concrete sense to, I think, the fear of the outsider or the foreign influence. And we can think about this specifically in an American context. If we took, off the top of my head, two examples, right? If we think about the Red Scare in the 1950s, or if you think about the civil rights struggle in the 50s and 60s, often on the right in this American context, the criticism would be that people struggling for civil rights or people who had fallen under the sway of communism or left-wing thinking in America had been subject to some nefarious foreign influence. And we could think about some of the more impalatable aspects of that reasoning. But that reasoning is absolutely attached to the Frankfurt School, right? Who like I said, have to flee Germany, move to America. And this is the point at which, according to the theory, they start to really infiltrate the institutions, the key institutions in the state. So people like Horkheimer, Adorno, working at universities, their ideas are beginning to percolate in the minds of the impressionable youth. And at that point, they can begin to really exert some underhand influence and get these communist ideas into wider circulation and eventually bring down Western civilization.
Yeah. So with apologies to Elon Musk, it certainly does sound like a conspiracy theory insofar as we have a very emotionally satisfying explanation for rapid social changes. We have identifiable villains involved rather than sort of complicated historical processes. And yet, one thing you make very clear in the essay is that there really was a cultural turn within Marxism. Mm-hmm. So this means, I guess, we can't entirely dismiss the cultural Marxism narrative as just a fabrication, just a conspiracy theory, right?
Actually, that's a really important distinction. So one of the things that's unique about the Frankfurt School, the historical Frankfurt School, right, is that, and again, it speaks to the idea of the grain of truth in this. Yes, these thinkers, particularly when Max Horkheimer is in charge of the institution, are very interested in culture. They do shift emphasis. Again, they are Marxist thinkers, away from, let's say, traditional economic analysis. And they take a real interest, you know, Adorno, for instance, is a musicologist, a sociologist, in cultural objects, cultural forms. And they work with these forms and write about them. So there is a very, absolutely, there is what we could call this cultural turn that's taken in a specific philosophical tradition, which in this sense would be Marxism, in the 1920s, in the 1930s, and through on into the 1940s. Now, what's interesting about that is, and maybe this speaks to the way in which the cultural Marxism conspiracy theory really kind of overplays the influence that these thinkers had. You know, these ideas weren't necessarily well received at the time by other Marxists. So we have people like Lukács, who's a great theorist of the novel, who accused the Frankfurt School of luxuriating in, what is it, the Grand Hotel Abyss, right? They contemplate in great luxury, but they're not actually really dedicated to the struggle to change the world. It's a criticism that continues, and it makes the cultural Marxism conspiracy narrative really quite ironic, right? That thinkers, and I would emphasize the thinker here, are somehow mobilized as these agents of great change. I mean, the famous example here would be Adorno. We could talk about Marcuse, who is interested in the student rights movement of the 1960s. But somebody like Adorno, who's obviously Marcuse's contemporary and collaborator, you know, he goes back to Germany after the war. Students in the 1960s were protesting Adorno for not committing to praxis, to struggle. So there is some mordant humor to be had in the fact that these are the figures, these almost like cutout villains that those on the right sort of gravitate towards, which again, to go back to it, leads me to suspect that they haven't actually spent much time getting to grips with some of the facts.
Well, on that, you know, one thing I find really interesting is that the term cultural Marxism is sometimes used seemingly interchangeably with postmodernism. Hmm. And, you know, both these phenomena are charged with hastening the decline of the West from within. They're both seen as agents of social and cultural corruption. But we have two very different sets of thinkers. We have the Frankfurt School behind cultural Marxism, supposedly, and then under the banner of postmodernism, we find the likes of Derrida, Foucault, other thinkers who right-wing commentators rarely, if ever, read. And these are thinkers who are often very critical of the Frankfurt School. Foucault certainly was. Is it a mistake to see these two intellectual traditions as closely related, or are there continuities you think worth exploring?
If we're thinking about people like the Frankfurt School, I'm going to do this in really broad brushstrokes. We have a group of thinkers who, though, as we just talked about, you know, are very interested in culture and shifting the terms of Marxist thought to a degree, they are still interested in what we would call, if we had a post-structuralist or postmodern hat on, they're interested in that idea of a meta-narrative, right? Something that can help account for or explain the world or how it, where we're at and where we're going. Marxism and the struggle and eventual resolution of class conflict, that is in its own way a meta-narrative. Now, that's the kind of narrative that post-structuralist, post-modernist thought is opposed to, not really interested in those grand narratives that we can tell ourselves to help account for the world. So in that sense, they're quite distinct. But I do think, again, if we're thinking about a cultural turn, we can, I think, establish points of continuity between these two schools of thought. You know, you mentioned Foucault, for instance. I think there's some interview somewhere where he talks about the fact that he wished he'd discovered the work of the Frankfurt School sooner than he did, and that could have informed his ideas. Or to take somebody like Derrida, Jacques Derrida, for instance, yes, very much interested in language and philosophical inquiry, but also in some modes very interested in history, right? There's the famous essay Spectres of Marx, where he's reflecting on the fall of the Berlin Wall and the ramifications for that. So I think if we're thinking very broadly, there are definite points of continuity, but I don't think that's the way in which, let's say, proponents, exponents of the cultural Marxism theory really understand those terms. I mean, postmodernism is a bit of a bugbear for me because I've, for my sins, written on it a fair bit. But often when you read documents from the culture wars of the 80s and 90s, for instance, I'm thinking of somebody like Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind. It's often just, again, going back to it, being used as a catch-all term. And I don't necessarily think the content of that term is really that important. It's really just, again, almost a shorthand for cultural decline. I think that's how, say, the term postmodernism is being mobilized. And I would say continues to be mobilized, despite the fact that, you know, some people have talked about the fact that postmodernism has been finished for decades now. It's strange, again, how terms and ideas continue to circulate.
Yeah. I've always thought of postmodernism as one of those ideas that's so big, it's an attractive target, because you can always sort of hit it with unerring accuracy, because it's just, you know, a mile wide. Yeah.
I mean, we could use other ones like deconstruction, for instance, but it serves a variety of purposes and can be mobilized in many different ways on any given day of the week.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and this week I'm talking about cultural Marxism with Alexander Howard, who's at the University of Sydney and has written a wonderful essay in The Conversation about cultural Marxism. More details on The Philosopher's Zone website. One thing you mentioned earlier that I'd like to come back to is the fact that key members of the Frankfurt School were Jewish refugees who had fled Europe and the Nazis. How important is that fact, the fact of their Jewishness, in understanding what later becomes the conspiracy theory around cultural Marxism?
There's a lot of discourse on discussion around cultural Marxism and how we might describe it as anti-Semitic. I would say that it bears, you know, many of the traits, the broad theories I think I sketched out at the start. A band of individuals moving in the shadows who are capable effectively of pulling the strings behind the scenes. That is a time-honored conspiracy theory. We could go back to something like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, right? The famous, notorious forgery, anti-Semitic forgery that gets picked up by people like Hitler and the Nazis, and is virulently anti-Semitic. I think the contours of the cultural Marxism conspiracy theory often move in equivalent ways. And to go back to, I think, what I said before about the fact that the original appearance of the term is in the 1930s in some, I think, British publication. And, you know, the other term that's often used, not in the present day context, but is used in discussions of cultural Marxism as a conspiracy theory, is that of cultural Bolshevism. And again, we're thinking there very clearly about explicitly anti-Semitic conspiratorial thinking. Now, I suppose the question becomes, do people who pick up the cultural Marxism narrative understand that? Or are they aware of it? You know, definitely if we're thinking about some of the exponents in an American context in the 1980s and 90s, if we looked into their backgrounds, I think we would find some fairly palatable behavior. But again, it's taken on this life of its own, I think, and we could think about how it's being used contemporarily.
Yeah, it seems to me to function as something of a dog whistle, you know, for those who have ears to hear it, in much the same way that globalist can function as a synonym for, you know, the cosmopolitan Jew who belongs nowhere and whose national loyalty is therefore always in question. It's a familiar pattern on the right, this dog whistling and then denial when called out for dog whistling. But you're saying that, you know, I guess we need to distinguish between the origins of the idea and the intentions of contemporary users of the idea. There's always a sort of slippage there.
To an extent, but I think you're absolutely right with the idea of the dog whistle. I think it can absolutely be used in that way. And I think, I mean, what is it about this group of German intellectuals that's so appealing to those on the right? And like you think you said, David, they really do effectively tick a lot of boxes. You know, the foreign influence, the outsider coming into a country, quite literally in the 1940s in the case of Adorno, and then somehow setting in train all of these sudden shifts that effectively account for everything that's starting to go wrong in, say, American society, if you're conservatively minded on the right of the political spectrum. Yeah, it's a really interesting one that I go back and forth with a little bit there.
Your essay in The Conversation is in part a review of a recent book on cultural Marxism by the historian A.J.A. Woods. And you note that in that book, Woods doesn't simply blame misinformation for the persistence of the conspiracy theory. He says that the political left bears some responsibility as well. What responsibility is that?
One of the things Woods is suggesting is a willingness to engage with or meet the right or the conspiratorial on its own terms. And that, in a way, could begin to normalize some otherwise unpalatable behavior. So I suppose I don't want to put words into Wood's mouth, but one thing I was thinking about is often we might hear now people express politically offensive ideas, but there can be, I think, almost a tendency to normalize or some aspects of behavior. And if we normalize it, it becomes part of everyday discourse. And I think Woods is trying to suggest that we need to be cautious about that if we're genuinely committed to change.
I'd like to talk a little bit about cultural Marxism and the long march through the institutions, particularly the modern university, where cultural Marxism is so often identified as a huge problem. In the end, and we'll start just by going broad here, how much influence would you say that thinkers like Adorno and Horkheimer and Marcuse have actually had on modern universities?
How long have we got? I suppose there it would depend on, you know, what part of the modern university we're talking about. So I work in the humanities and arts and social sciences. I'd say that, yes, that they do have influence. How great that influence is another question altogether. I might, if that's okay, just give an example about the context in which I work, right? So I work in the department, the discipline of English and writing. I'm very interested in the models of critical reading and interpretation. Those thinkers that we've talked about, Adorno, again, somebody like Walter Benjamin, the ideas that they develop. And they offer, amongst other things, interpretive keys with which you might approach a given work, a given cultural object. That model of reading, broadly speaking, we could class as almost suspicious, right? We take a work, a text, and we look to see what it can tell us, and we look to puzzle things out. That mode of reading, particularly when I was going through my own march of the institutions as a student, was quite prevalent in certain sections of the university, less so now. You know, for instance, if I'm thinking in the English context, we have the rise of things, schools of thought, such as the idea of the post-critical school of thought, which is very distinct from the model of thinking and criticism that we get with the Frankfurt School. So I suppose what I'm suggesting here is, again, that this is almost a bit like a trap that one could fall into, to think that the Frankfurt School has this oversized, outlandish influence on the institution. It's certainly there, but I wouldn't suggest that students are necessarily force-fed the diet of Frankfurt School critical theory from the time they arrive in the institution. But it's a fascinating one, because if we go back to the 1960s, again, the historical record shows that, yes, people like Herbert Marcuse are very involved with the student protests, student movements of that historical period, for sure, and do have a real influence and are very much key movers in particular circles and intellectual circles and activist circles in the 1960s. But again, whether that influence continues into the present day, I'm not so sure.
It's usually told as a story of gradual ideological capture, isn't it? It's not like something happened and now here we are. It's more that, you know, if we look back to the 1950s and maybe early 1960s, there was this sort of breadth of thinking, breadth of politics at universities, which has really narrowed. There's been this sort of ideological narrowing over time, a sort of ideological clustering. And that will often prompt a sort of a wholesale rejection on the part of academics of this idea of ideological capture. And yet, surveys do consistently find that humanities and social science faculties lean overwhelmingly to the political left. Is that relevant to the conversation that we're having? Do you think it matters here?
Is there the hard data to suggest that? I mean, look, again, just in my context, I would say that we have a whole host of diverse views, political perspectives. So I'm not so necessarily sure about that. And I also wonder, given the context in which we're talking today about a particular conspiracy theory, I wonder if we're almost rehearsing some of the arguments or some of the assumptions that we get in that theory itself, right? That there has been this idea of ideological capture or takeover. I mean, I'd like to see the evidence to suggest that's actually happening. I mean, we could look to some of the narratives that we get on the right, for instance, when we talk about the rise of the quote-unquote rise of supposed political correctness on campus, for instance, or the idea of cancel culture. But very quickly, when we do that, we get brought back into these broader narratives that could feasibly lead us in some difficult directions, for sure. But again, it's interesting, we talk about these terms, you know, cancel culture, political correctness, postmodernism. Again, it's a shared vocabulary that exists. And I'm not hesitant, but I'm slightly wary of some of the catchphrases that we associate with cultural Marxism, because it puts us back onto that terrain where we're almost caught in a web that we can't get out of. And I think this is kind of Wood's point as well, with the bind in which the political left finds itself, trying to fight almost the culture wars on the culture wars' own terms, which I think is a pretty perilous position to be in. And I think, actually, to try and bring it back to the, you know, historical Frankfurt School, they're interested and they develop critical theory. The idea that, again, broad brushstrokes, taking that step back and being able to and Adorno would take a step back and sit down and think and really think about it, to understand where we're positioned and to think about the assumptions and the social forces that encounter and shape our ideas. And I think that would be a much broader conversation, longer conversation we could think about in relation to the quote-unquote modern institution Yeah, there's a lot to say about ideological capture and the quote-unquote neoliberal institution, which is a term that I think would sit quite squarely against some of the narratives of the cultural Marxist takeover if we thought about what the neoliberal university institution looks like in the present day.
Well, if we think about the enormous cultural changes that people typically point to when they invoke cultural Marxism, we've mentioned some of these already, the decline of traditional Christianity, the transformation of the family, the advent of feminism, LGBTQ rights, identity politics, on and on and on. These are all things that exist and that supposedly follow from cultural Marxism. So if we were to retire that phrase, cultural Marxism, altogether, how should we talk about these changes?
That's a very big question. I think we would have to develop or to use a completely different frame of reference, right? Because these are all, like you say, changes that have occurred over a long period of history. But I suppose, how would you go about doing it, David? I'm trying to hedge my bets here because it's, look.
I thought you were going to turn the question back on me when we were talking about political bias in cultural institutions. I was really worried about that. We can have a go at it
because it's, what we're talking about when we're talking about the cultural Marxism conspiracy, right? If we're talking about how it gains traction, we're talking about people, he says, without naming names, who are unhappy with change or who are dissatisfied about change. What is at the root of their dissatisfaction? Now, maybe we could think, and here maybe it was something that the Frankfurt School would be interested in doing, thinking about the social forces that move us or organize us, thinking about the society in which we move and exist. Now, we could say that there's something deeply unsatisfactory about the world in which we exist. Adorno's interested in the wrong life, for instance. Now, if we begin to do that, we might think about these issues as symptoms of some broader cultural malaise, but about this idea of progress or progressive decline. But now, David, what do you think?
Well, my answer, I suppose, would be as broad as the question, as unforgivably broad as the question, which is just that history is sort of overdetermined. You know, there are always multiple independent causes for all these things. And if we were going to really unpack it all, we'd need to talk about capitalism and
you said it, not me.
Demographic change, technological transformation, political conflict. It's all playing into it, which that's sort of a broad enough answer to be almost trite. But
I don't think it is, because if we, all of the things you just listed there, sort of demographic change, technological change, these are actually precisely the things that the Frankfurt School are interested in. You know, for instance, somebody like Walter Benjamin, who I feel determined to give a shout out to, one of the great theorists of media, and he's really, really on the money and capable of diagnosing massive changes. He's talking about mechanical reproduction, technological reproduction, the advent of photography and film, and how that impacts our understanding of or how we experience art and the world. Adorno as well is interested in the medium of the radio and some of the potentially problematic ways that medium could be used. Then it's ironic that his investigations into the radio, into that medium in particular, get picked up by the cultural Marxist conspiracy theorists as evidence that Adorno is interested in brainwashing. But I think, again, yeah, absolutely. One of the things about the cultural Marxism conspiracy theory is it does away with all of that nuance, right? And again, gives us something almost like a soundbite with which we can understand how we've arrived where we have. And that seems to be appealing in many ways. Are we willing to do the hard work to really understand how we've arrived where we have? I think the Frankfurt School are interested in doing that work. Are the people who are cultural Marxist conspiracy theorists interested in doing that? I'm not necessarily sold on that idea, taking the time to reflect on our behaviors, or taking the time to, for instance, to think about, you mentioned, broad, massive demographic shifts and changes or migration patterns, what are the kinds of things that impact those issues, right? We then, I do think, as you, and you named it, have to think about social arrangements. And what is it about, now I've definitely got my Frankfurt School hat on, what is it about the contemporary societal arrangement we find ourselves in that is capable of producing and perpetuating massive social inequality, right? The Frankfurt School, to go back to the historical Frankfurt School, for instance, acknowledge that there is suffering in the world, right? That's a fact. But they also clued into the idea and critical of the idea of what they would call needless suffering. Now, we as human agents have a degree of agency, but we're shaped by social forces, some would say deformed by those forces. But there is nothing, the Frankfurt School would suggest, to suggest that needless suffering needs to exist in the world. You know, if we think about how many millions of displaced people we have, refugees. So there might, you know, there is, I think, a lot of work to be done in understanding those problems and those issues. And yeah, I think Frankfurt School critical theory is capable of doing that in a way that cultural Marxism as a conspiracy theory is not. But one of those things is more popular in the contemporary imagination than the other.
It's making me think about, and I'll make this my final question, another thing that the Frankfurt School thinkers were very interested in, which as good Marxists they would be, which is the sort of anomy and alienation experienced by people living under capitalism. And it makes me think about another conversation that I had on this show a few years back with a scholar who was interested in why conspiracy theories take off, particularly anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, but conspiracy theories in general. And he talked about it in terms of an aesthetic appeal. It's the excitement of getting caught up in a narrative and finding oneself almost like a sort of a player in the narrative. And that belief in the conspiracy theory is not really as important as what we might call the willing suspension of disbelief. You sort of enter into the theory in the way that you would enter into the exciting world of a novel or a movie. And I would love to put that as a question to the likes of Adorno and Horkheimer, who had so much to say about the entertainment industry and the way in which we are all liable to entertain ourselves into this state of paralytic decay. Is that something that you would go along with?
I love it. I mean, again, just some of the ironies that maybe we should really hammer home here. Yes, Adorno, Horkheimer, massive critics of the so-called culture industry. Yet in the narratives of the cultural Marxism conspiracy theory are actually kind of responsible for cultural decline and the rise of mass culture. There's a great, I think it's in the Woods book actually, where the idea of Adorno, who famously, notoriously hates jazz, for instance, and is only really interested in classical composition, Schoenberg, somehow, and I'm sure this is actually, somebody did say this, wrote, put this down somewhere, you can draw a line between Adorno and Led Zeppelin, for instance. I would love to put that to Adorno. You know, Adorno is the fifth Beatle. I think that's what Woods quotes or says. But there is, I mean, that's fascinating about the conversation you're having about the aesthetic appeal, or maybe we could call it the aesthetics of conspiratorial thinking. And we could perhaps even do that historically, right? If we think about the rise of the so-called paranoid political thriller, right, in the 1970s, for instance. I'm thinking here of films, for instance. Stuff like All the President's Men, for instance, or Clute, or The Parallax View. Again, what's happening at that historical moment, there seems to be a profound loss of faith, and I'm giving myself away as a trained Americanist here, because all my examples seem to be American. Thinking about, say, the Watergate scandal, the loss of faith in a political system, the uncertainty that throws up, that discomfort that individuals and society collectively experiences, maybe there's a desire to gravitate towards something graspable or seemingly understandable, or something that gives you potentially some kind of semblance or illusion of agency or participation or control. And I think there's something about conspiratorial thinking, paranoid thinking, if you will, to go back to Richard Hofstadter's theorization famously in the States, that almost like has a kind of balming effect, can reassure you that actually, you know, things can be understood. You can participate. You can, if you like, choose your own adventure. And that could be reassuring. I mean, I think back, now you've got me going with this, David, about, you know, COVID times and the seemingly sudden emergence of, you know, do you remember this? The QAnon conspiracy theory.
Yeah, yeah. As if out of nowhere.
As if out of nowhere. Everywhere. But then, because like you, I'm really fascinated by conspiracy theory, there's various texts that we associate with the QAnon phenomenon. And it's all conspiracy theories rolled into one, effectively. But absolutely, the broad contours of something like the cultural Marxist conspiracy theory are absolutely there in the QAnon theory, which is effectively some shadowy elite, some deep state who have sought to corrupt, undermine, quote-unquote, Western civilization. We need to fight against that, and we can choose particular figures who are going to fight that fight for us, supposedly, but then actually, weirdly, never actually do anything to bring about the unmasking of the deep state. So I guess what I'm saying here is these conspiracy theories don't really ever change. And then we could get back onto the territory of anti-Semitism, amongst other things. But yes, it's a really, I don't want to say rich and fertile area, because it's also, aside from being intellectually interesting, this stuff can have and has had some, you know, truly horrifying, disastrous real-world consequences, right? If you think about, for instance, Andreas Breivik, he's quoting texts on cultural Marxism and political correctness in his so-called manifesto that he publishes. So again, these are, you know, live and dangerous ideas, and yeah, there's a lot more that we could talk about for sure. But yes, the aesthetics of conspiratorial thinking. There's definitely a book in that if it hasn't been written yet.
Well, there is a Philosopher's Zone episode, and I'm going to put the link to that
please
on the webpage for this episode. And Alex, look, you're right, there is a lot more to talk about, but we are pretty well out of time. I'm just going to pick up on one thing that you said there, which is that you mentioned the movie Clute, and I had forgotten about Clute. That is such a great movie. Shout out to the listeners if you are into a good 1970s paranoid conspiracy thriller. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Donald Sutherland, Jane Fonda at their best.
It was a particularly rich historical window for a particular genre of film to emerge, kind of long for a reemergence of that genre. I mean, it's interesting, if I'm now pushing it just into a discussion about film, that there's also, I'd say, an interest in the so-called paranoid political thriller that emerges in the 1990s. Now, I can't remember the name of the author, but there's been a relatively recent book somewhere, I completely forget the name, talking about the general cultural zeitgeist of the early 90s. You know, we've got things like the rise of the X-Files. Again, very interested in this idea of the conspiratorial. And I wonder if, well, I don't wonder, I think we can actually do it pretty easily. We could think about and begin to map the ways in which particular conspiracy theories emerge at a given political historical moment. If we're thinking in the 90s and we're thinking about the way in which culture seems to be permeated with this paranoid distrust, particularly of authority figures, we can absolutely think about something like the New World Order as a conspiracy theory, which, if you spend time with the people pushing that theory, again, will bring you back quite quickly to the cultural Marxism theory as well. So again, these ideas circulate and emerge at interesting historical junctures. And I think we could perhaps think about that in relation to certain tech bros' interest in cultural Marxism in the 2020s and what that might say about our own historical moment. And then make us also wonder as to whether things have changed all that much since the theory itself got going in the 1960s.
Well, as an appropriately ominous note on which to wind it up, Alex, it's been wonderful to talk. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, David. It's been fun.
Alexander Howard, Senior Lecturer in English and Writing at the University of Sydney, author of a wonderful piece on cultural Marxism that was published recently in The Conversation. We'll put a link to that on the Philosopher's Zone website. And just one thing I wanted to mention before we go is that the annual Alan Saunders Lecture is coming up in just a few weeks' time. It's going to be a live public event hosted at the ABC in Sydney on Thursday, the 24th of September. I'll tell you more about it next week, but if you just can't wait until next week, you'll find a link to all the information and details of how to register for tickets on the Philosopher's Zone website. That's the Alan Saunders Lecture, live at the ABC in Sydney on September the 24th. It's free, but you do have to register. So that's it for this week. The Philosopher's Zone is produced on the lands of the Bundjalung people by me, David Rutledge. Lovely to have you along. See you next time.